Hi, everyone. I'm Henrik Palmgren. You are listening to Red Eyes Radio. I hope you had a good week and a good Thanksgiving if you're in the United States. I know you guys love that turkey and gravy, and I don't blame you. I've had it a few times. That's actually pretty good. Well, we have some good posts on redicecreations.com, our website, on that particular holiday as well, and how it's turned into this kind of modern propaganda war. This has gone from something that previously was a history that the alternative and also, interestingly, the cultural Marxists in the universities pushed on their students. And now, as these students have grown up and brought with them this very unbalanced view of history, it's become a mainstream narrative. And that is, of course, seeking to demonize and put blame on those horrible white Americans today, without never mentioning things like King Philip's War or Metacombs War, as it's also known as. See, it's not about getting to what really happened. It's about getting to what really happened and understanding how history is being used against you in the long run, whether it's true or not. It's become about taking every opportunity to make you feel guilty about who you are as a way to undermine your confidence in yourself and piggyback political issues and issues of control on psychological processes that makes you surrender in your own mental environment before you even begin. I mean, again, whether it's true or not should be examined, but from our detractors' point of view, they don't care about the objective truth or what really happened. To them, it's a war, and you're the target, and they use everything they can in their arsenal against you. I think the sooner you wake up to this, the better it is. I mean, why should you feel guilty and apologize for something that you had no control over whatsoever? So if you are in America, I hope you had a good Thanksgiving and continue to celebrate it for what it is and what it means to you and make it into something good, not a holiday of guilt, as they're seeking to do. Our guest today is Anthony Michels from Holland. He is an interest-free currency activist and founder of the Geller, the first regional currency in the Netherlands. He has written extensively about usury, currencies, monetary reform, and other topics such as feminism, cultural Marxism, Hitler's banking system, and much more that you can read on his blog, Real Currencies. I think we can all agree that the world is run by a mercantile class today, even if it's just a means to an end. The economy rules us and it sets the direction and pace. So I think it's first important to go into the history of the transformation of the smaller market economies that we used to have in Europe and how it became this kind of global usury-based monster that it is today. We're also going to try to get to the core issue of the problem, which in Anthony's view is not debt, but interest. Hi, Anthony. Thank you for speaking with us today. We're very glad to have you here. Thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you so much, Henrik, for having me on the show.
Well, you bet. We're obviously going to talk about the very central core issue problem of economics today and how this, of course, is creating so many subset of issues and problems from, of course, the way we live to, the political system and everything else that are basically centered around the main economic problem. And a little bit later, too, I want to talk more about some of the alternative currencies. I know you're working on this. But before we kind of get started on some of the core issues here, tell us when you started your website, Real Currencies, Anthony, and kind of what was the incentive for you to get started in this area?
Okay. Well, I started awakening politically, I think, about 10 years ago now, in the aftermath of the Iraq invasion. And the 9/11, of course, which preceded that. And one of the first films that I ever saw was Bill Still's The Money Masters, which is obviously a very legendary film. And that was really very important for me. It was a real breakthrough. And then I realized that we were, well, apparently being ruled by a banking cartel, and that we were actually slaves. And this was a huge shock for me at the time, and took me a little while to recover from it. But when I did, the first question that I asked myself, okay, if we're dealing with a banking cartel, obviously I need to know about what money is. So I started some real deep investigation into the matter, both from a monetary perspective, an economic perspective, a historical perspective, because these three are all closely intertwined and cannot be seen apart from each other. And economics is not a science. It is politics. It is about whether it is explaining why the rich get richer, or it is, on the other hand, explaining how the common man maintains control over his own production and thus can be free because a common man produces more than enough for himself and his family to survive. And the problem is that usury, we'll be going into that a little later, but usury is the way that he's been basically disowned from his own production, and usury, scarce money, the boom-bust cycle, other issues related to the monetary. So I really got into that very deeply, and shortly thereafter, I quit my job. I was having some sort of a corporate career, and I dumped that, and I got into the alternative currency business. I opened up a very primitive at the time first alternative currency here in Arnhem, where I live, and I've been working on that ever since. Many ups and downs, but. And then about real currencies, yeah, you know, when I started diving into the internet and diving into all sorts of conspiracy websites, and you start reading about the Rothschilds and you know, the whole shebang. I think most people listening to this show will know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, what started to stun me badly was seeing that the whole truth movement, which is basically assuming that we are being run by a central banking cartel or a banking cartel moving towards world currency and world governments, eh? And we can discuss who is behind all this, whether it's the Jews or whether it's just bankers or the Vatican or what have you. You have all these theories, but what is clear is that those who are behind this world government movement are the ones that are behind the banks, and that the banks are the core of their temporal power, because the banks control everything in the economy. When you control the money supply, and this is my basic message also on real currencies, when you control the money supply, you control the entire economy. And when you if people don't realize what money is, then they can be ripped off with usury, with scarce money, with the deflations, with the derivatives, and all sorts of ridiculous hoaxes that should have absolutely no place in a rational monetary system. And and then I saw how the whole truth movement was basically being subverted and taken over by libertarianism and its godforsaken goldbuggery. And this stunned me, because to me it was blatantly obvious that that gold had been controlled by the money power for, well, literally millennia, and that all the gold is in their hands, and that obviously gold is not going to allow the end of usury. It's not going to allow the gold is money, I mean. I want to clearly differentiate between buying a little bit of gold as a hedge against the coming meltdown, because that meltdown is coming, and gold will be a good hedge in that case. But basing a money supply on it is something completely different. And the idea that libertarianism and Austrian economics promotes, that we should have gold-based money and that the bankers cannot fool with us, they cannot print money if you have gold-based money, etc. This is just so outrageously ridiculous. And that's what basically motivated me to get really start blogging on a big time to dispel that myth.
All right, very good. Well, a lot of points there obviously that we need and can go deeper into. I think we have a lot of casualties by the type of you know, capitalist system that we've seen, internationalists, really, bankers that are running the world, and we have tons of different consequences how this plays out. And I do want to try to get some of those later there, but before we talk about, you know, what effects we see in the modern world today, and I think a lot of people can recognize what those are already, and you know, they have if they have their eye on the ball, they realize what these are, and we'll get to those. But let's just talk a little bit about the history here and about how things changed in your view, Anthony, because I think you have mentioned this too before we started the recording. I think you have a unique perspective being in Amsterdam, you know, looking at the Dutch Empire, and of course, when the system of usury actually came in, we have, you know, William of Orange, for example, bringing it from, you know, Amsterdam to Britain, etc. There is a migration of the Jews at that same time, merchantilism, if you will, as well. But how do you view when this was incoming? I know even people go even further back, the Norman conquest of England, for example. This was another wave earlier, back in 1060 or 1080 or something like that. What's your sort of view on this?
Yeah, well, you know, Henrik, and this has become more and more clear to me over the years. It wasn't so clear when I started out writing on real currencies, but I've always had a strong interest in history, and I've been studying it for 30 years now. But the longer you look at it, the more you start to see that usury and this and the battle against plutocracy, in whatever form, is really the underlying current of all human history throughout the ages. I mean, the Roman Empire, for instance, why did it collapse ultimately? It collapsed because after centuries of usury, all the wealth and all the assets and all the land in the empire was concentrated in very, very few hands, and this became ultimately unsustainable. And this is the unavoidable end game of any usurious system, any economy that is based on usury. And we will see that capitalism is nothing but banking and usury. Is that every time you have a usurious economy, ultimately everything will be owned by the very richest. Compound interest makes this unavoidable. And this is what has happened in the Roman Empire, and that's why it ultimately collapsed. And I've become convinced that the interest-free economy of the medieval era under the Vatican was actually a response to that, because people must have known at the time what the real cause of the collapse was, and usury had been exposed by this humongous catastrophe that had been exposed as a total cancer. And that's why in medieval Europe, usury was considered a mortal sin,
Yeah,
which is, of
exactly.
course, also biblical, because Jesus tells us to lend freely and expecting nothing in return, and outlaws usury in very direct terms in that verse. But and what you had in the medieval era, and this is really mind-blowing, and very few people realize this, but especially after, say, the year 1000, when the worst excesses of the collapse and the dark ages that had resulted from the Roman collapse and the end of civilization as they knew it back then, European civilization started to build up. You saw the first skeletons of nation states, particularly in France, but also in Italy, of course, and Britain. Very much so, and this is when you saw that the living standards in Europe were actually much higher than was very common in the modern age. For instance, the British living standards in Britain in the 13th, 14th, 15th century, the common man would work 15 weeks per year to feed his entire family. And we think of these people as serfs, and they were serfs. They had a not so good legal position, and they were, of course, beholden to their landlords. But in terms of what they lost to income, they lost about 10 to 20% of their income to land rents and taxes. Whereas the common man these days, without even knowing it, loses 40% to usury, even if he's not in debt. I'll talk a little bit about that later. But usury, and then above usury, we have taxation, and we have high prices of monopoly, because all the international transnational cartels that we see, whether it's energy or big pharma, telecommunications, these are all just completely controlled markets, cartels, basically owning each other, all owned by the banking system. So it's all one huge monopolistic block, and they keep prices high. That's what monopolists do, and that sucks away even more of our life force. So the standard of living of the British common man was much higher than, for instance, the 19th century, which was the heyday of capitalism and the heyday of the British Empire. Britain ruled the waves, was the most powerful empire ever, controlled one third of the global land mass. But the British common man was sweating away in the sweatshops for 70 hours a week at below sustenance income. And that is really amazing. And it was only in the 60s of this century that the British common man achieved the same height, body height, as he did in the 13th, 14th century. So this is the usury-free economy of the medieval era. And then you saw this huge break with a usury prohibition, which came about 1500. Say, you can't pinpoint it exactly, of course, because these
Right.
are long-term trends and et cetera. But around 1500, you'd see that usury really was becoming more and more commonplace. And you had, for instance, Henry VIII, who created an act against usury, which was, of course, allowing usury because lawmakers have known about Orwellian language for a long time. And why was this happening? For a key reason was, for instance, Calvinism. And Calvin was probably a Jew himself. There is reason to believe that he was actually Cohen. And one of his main achievements for the money power was that he allowed usury in a Christian context. And this then infected the Dutch Republic because the Dutch Republic rebelled against the Spanish in 1568 because of the fact that they were adopting Calvinism. And a lot of Jews had come from Spain after being expelled in 1492 from after the Reconquista was completed in Spain. They were expelled, and a lot of them came to Holland. And well, that coming together, the Jews plus the end of usury prohibition, Calvinism in Holland being strong, that created an atmosphere and well, let's call it a business environment for the Jews, which allowed them to create the first big time capitalist empire. Perhaps not the first, because Venice was also a very important precursor of capitalism. So capitalism built first in Venice, as we know today. It came to then moved on to Amsterdam as its headquarters, and later, the Puritans in England, and the Puritans are Calvinists also, let in the Jews again in the late 17th century.
Do you,
With the
sorry, keep, remember where we were at that, but I just want, has this been a natural, organic kind of transference to different parts of the world, or do you think there was another reason, a planned movement of this type of empire building, do you think?
Well, I think that the Jews had their eyes set on London, and London itself. A lot of the merchants were very much against the Jews coming over because they knew they would be in trouble because of their practices. But the empire builders in London themselves were very thrilled with the Jew with having the Jews over because they realized that they would be very important in their own ambitions. And having seen what they had done in Amsterdam, and Amsterdam at the time had been, Holland is a really small country. At the time, there were 2 million people living in the Dutch Republic, and still it was strong enough to fend off an ambitious France and the British Empire and wage war on in the 30-Year War in Germany all at the same time. So that gives you an idea of the kind of gigantic economic might that was assembled in Amsterdam. And so the Londoners were jealous of this, and this was one reason why they wanted the Jews to come back into the country after having been expelled them in 1290, I think it was. And whether it was a long-term plan, I've come to see that the money power does plan over a very, very long periods of time. They have scenarios that can actually span centuries. So I think that at the time they were already at this, but how much was actually planned or how much goes organically, I think they have to react also to what's happening in the wider world. So I think they're excellent opportunists, and they can combine long-term strategy with short-term tactics, as a good chess player should. So
Yeah, no, definitely. What do you think? There's any? We've talked about this on the show many times. We've talked about usury in the past. We've talked about how Europe has gone through these lot of different transformations and whatnot, and a lot of these have been monetarily run, and a lot of things have been, risen and fallen, collapses and everything else. But do you think that there's any kind of antagonism behind the way that the monetary system has been used against the European peoples throughout the last millennia, pretty much? Is there
There can absolutely zero doubt about that, Henrik. It is a purely predatory system, and the handlers of the system know this full well. They know exactly what they're doing. If you read the protocols, especially the later chapters which deal with the financial system, they are incredibly insightful, and they also explain how it's just a huge hoax, and that by the time they get into their kingdom, as they put it, that parasitism, which is usury, is will be strictly outlawed. And in the Old Testament, let us not forget this, in the Old Testament, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, their God, He expressly commands the Jews to set out conquering the world with lending and borrowing. In Deuteronomy, he says that a couple of times. You will rule by lending, and you will lend to the other nations, and you will not borrow from them. That's what it says.
I didn't even know that, actually. That's interesting. I got to pull. It's like, yeah, exactly. That's right. 15:6 or something like that. I gotta add a link to that. That's interesting. But so, you know, in the past shows we've talked quite a bit about the free market and I like the idea of that, no doubt. I think it's a good idea to a certain extent. A market system, much of even, let's say, where, you know, the Middle Ages perhaps was, I think, a free market system of sorts. It was just, of course, local. It was not international as it is today. And of course, taxation, and this is a different animal. We can talk more about that later too, what your take on that is. But the free market, or capitalism in particular, has of course made me question more recently in turn, you know, of how this will create an environment that is good for, you know, people, and the idea that the market can run everything, and if it does, it will just kind of normalize to its perfect type of way of life that it's meant to be. I mean, that the merchant class can run everything to a level of optimum is kind of a reverse socialism in a sense, where a centralized organization believes that they can tell the people what they need to live a good life, you know. But this is kind of a reverse scenario of that, in the same way that the market will give you everything you need. But what I've come to realize is that there's little to no consideration for what is good for the people, ultimately. There's little, I'd say, culture recognition for even ethnicity and nations. And I think one of the big consequences of this, we'll get to maybe more later detail, but is things like mass immigration, where the system itself is so predatory that it needs constant growth all the time. There's natural cycles. Things rise and fall. There is, upswing, there's downswing. It's just how it is. This system demands a continuous growth. And with that, it completely steamrolls over people and nations and what it needs to do to kind of survive. So that's been my biggest point of critique more recently. I've come to realize that mass immigration is a huge consequence as a way they're trying to legitimize it, of course, by just completely always having more people and a growth cycle. Tell us a little bit about if you think there are any good aspects to the free market, and how that maybe differs from the capitalism that we see today.
Yeah, well, you know, free market is just another Orwellian word construct for monopoly, because as I've been already saying, all the major markets are basically run by transnational cartels who own each other and who are in turn owned by the banks. And there is no free market, never has been. And well, maybe in the medieval era indeed. Because if you have usury on the money supply, you will always see this immense concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a very few. And this free market idea is just basically it's about disallowing the community to interfere with the market to stop predatory practices. And that's why the money power itself is behind all this free market fundamentalism, because there can be no doubt about the fact that libertarianism as a thought construct has been created by the billionaires, by the trillionaires, and they have put billions and billions into this, into making people like von Hayek, Mises, and Rothbard big, and all these ridiculous think tanks that you have in the United States, which have been proliferating over the last decades. These have been created. I have a number of articles about that on my website also, but these have been created with all the guidance and leadership and money from the money power that is behind all that thought constructs, including Marxism, etc., because Marxism and libertarianism are basically the two major extremes of the dialectic, the capitalist versus Marxist dialectic that we see, and they're both absolutely, totally predatory, unnatural, and contrary to all men. And the free market, what you need to have in a balanced economy, an economy obviously should serve the community. The fact that the economy has become all important has also been well described in the protocols, by the way. But this distracts us from the political body, and from the cultural body, and from the family body, and which is all being slowly but surely commercialized and being made subservient to the economic body. And obviously, the economy is just about sustenance. That's all it is. Nothing more, nothing less. It's a very important, but it's not the end all, and it's not the
Right.
goal in itself.
Yeah.
So the free market obviously cannot govern all our relations. Obviously not. It is very subservient to many other relations, which are much more important. For instance, we are brothers. So there can be no free market with endless extortion and the so-called voluntary contracts, which are all based on artificial scarcity and the monopoly positions. And this is all bullshit. And people like Rothbard, who was one of the main thinkers of libertarianism, in his insanity in making the free market too big, he openly proclaimed the necessity for a free market for children, for instance, where parents can sell their children. And that is the insanity to which this free market fundamentalism inexorably leads to. And it is pure materialism, and it is devoid of all love, of all spirituality, of all compassion between men and women, of course. The importance of our culture, of what we want to do together as a community, and how we organize this, and the idea that a cutthroat competition in the market and winner takes all is a good way to build a society is purely for ignoramuses only, in my view.
Right. I like the Rothbard, attack things like egalitarianism and obviously some of the Marxist ideologies. But again, that doesn't mean that what is offered by the opposition have everything, that we need to make good decisions here. I think we have spiritual needs, right? We have things that are to a certain extent, I guess for a better word, metaphysical. They go beyond the materialistic. They go beyond the needs of what the market can supply. These are, religious ideas, if you want to use that term. There are ideas of aspiration, higher purpose, as what a people want to have achieved through their lifetime, even as a nation, etc. There are things like this behind everything, which are forgotten in this very materialistic, market system. But at the same time, that we're oh, sorry, go ahead. Do you want to comment on that?
No. I'm just agreeing fully with you here.
Now, we are so estranged to the concept of a good leader as well, or someone that actually has the interest of the people at heart. It's so foreign to us that I think we tend to look elsewhere. We tend to look for a system or a method or something that will save us from the aspect that we can have good men and women in positions of leadership that actually do things that are good. So today we're so devoid of that, Anthony, and that's why I think we have a tendency, and this is true in the conspiracy movement too, that a lot of people are just, whoever gets up there is going to be bought and paid for, and that's probably true in our day and age. But what about the idea of having, still going to the idea that having a system which is good for the people, and yes, that has, economy in effect, which is not about egalitarianism of bringing down everything to its lowest common denominator and leveling out into this one as a glob and what have you. There's got to be a balance here somewhere, right? There's got to be a view of where we can attain a
Yes.
society which is achievable and good for the people, correct?
Yes, very much so. And let me get into this on an economic level, because you're very right, of course, that we cannot have endless egalitarianism. It's contrary to nature, and every human being has his own place in life, and some people take a bigger place than other people, and it's also got to do with age. Older people have a higher rank in human society by nature than younger people, and that is the way it should be. The experienced should lead the unexperienced, and make sure that the elderly and the children and the women are provided for. And this is how things should be organized. And economically speaking, this means that men should work, and they should be able to maintain control over their own production. So if they're working in a greater organization, if they produce 200K worth per year, then they should be getting about 190K of that production themselves. And the rest is added value for the corporation. But what is happening now is that people work there, they get paid 50,000, and they produce 250,000. And the organization, and particularly the shareholders, they net all the rest. And why can this be so? Because capital is scarce and expensive. And those providing the capital have all the power in the economy, instead of people working having all the power. And this is because of scarce money and usury. And if we have a usury-free economy, what you will see is that normal people can invest in their own business, not in other people's businesses, no, in their own business, so that they can create goods and services that are wanted by the community, and in this way provide for their own sustenance and of that of their families and the community and what have you. And the normal working common man should remain in control of what he produces for his own betterment, and from so that he, from his own control, can decide how he's going to share this with other people, instead of being robbed, etc., by taxation, usury, and all the other issues that I've already mentioned. Because how bad is it at the moment? And let me get this on record here, because I think it's really very important to get a clear view of how utterly we enslaved we already are. And the fact is that we already lose 40% of our disposable income to usury, even if we have zero debts. And why is this so? Simply because producers incur costs for capital, and they have to during production, and these costs compound in the supply chain, and they obviously have to pass these costs on to the consumers, being us. So 40% of prices we pay is basically usury passed on by the producers, and this is a nightmarish situation, because where is all this money going? And this is the essence of the whole thing. It is unearned income, because the usurer, the banker, and the people who are already own billions or trillions even, these are the ones that are gaining most in this usury racket. And they are just sitting on their ass, and they're raking in trillions per year, because globally you're talking about a 5 to 10 trillion wealth transfer from the poorest 80% to the richest 10%, of which most ends up with the very richest. And this is an ongoing redistribution. It's pure socialism for the rich. It is an automatic...
Right.
Yeah. So what we need to do is we need to have a monetary system that no longer redistributes, either from rich to poor or from poor to rich. But the only problem in reality is the redistribution from the many to the few. And this will create a stable situation where you can have great differences between very brilliant people who work very hard. They can create a lot of goods and services, and they will become wealthy, and they can have a great span of control. But they have earned this in their own hard work, with their own talents, their own God-given place in life. They have taken this place, and they have provided a great many people with their added value. And therefore, they have a great place in the economic sphere. And this is good. And this is earned income versus unearned income, because the problem is with unearned income, once you have a certain amount of money, say a few billion, you just you rake in so much yearly through usury that you can never spend it back into circulation again. The only thing that you can do is reinvest it and make even more money, and then you have this compound interest situation. And we all know the basic math of 5% per year over 1,000 years, or even 100 or 200 years, and it leads to humongous numbers. And it is automatic that when you're wealthy and you can just become more and more richer every year, 5%, you will own everything within a few generations. And that is what happens, because these old families, they just keep the wealth in the family in trust funds, and you know how it goes.
Yeah.
And it just grows 5% per year, and they're raking in trillions at the moment.
And all of this is due to the system that's there in place, you know, rewarding the very aspect if you, you know, have money. And then, of course, on top of that, we do have the different variations of money creation and fractional reserve lending, and, you know, all these issues that are occurring on top of it. But at the same time, I want to mention that, you know, and I think you're right there. You're basically talking about ending redistribution, wherever that goes, if it goes from top down or from bottom up, it doesn't matter. But this idea as well, that a lot of people are, you know, look at the situation in France, for example, where, you know, they have the death tax kind of issue, that if you want to pass, if you've worked hard all your life and you want to pass something down to your children, they basically end up taking, I don't know what the death tax is in France right now, 75%, 80% or something like that.
It's a disgrace. And it's really a hardcore issue for the globalists. You see it in all their faux opposition proposals also to create a death tax, because that is what is so-called unfair. And why is this attractive to many people because they know that these families keep the wealth into the family themselves. Eh? So they think, oh, it will apply for them too. But obviously it won't because all their wealth is in trust funds.
Right. So they find a way of hiding for that. And then again, you get to who's hit, you know, the middle class is hit as usual, the hardest, right? Those who are kind of in the in-between state there. But let's talk a little bit more about, you know, some of the bigger issues here with the economic system and money creation and debt as well, because there are many factions to what is wrong with the system per se. It's not only usury, of course, but let's talk about money creation for a little bit on how this is done.
Well, yeah, of course, money creation is a huge issue, and money is created as debt, as is now commonly known in the truth movement. You go into a bank and you take out a loan, and the bank doesn't have any money. It creates the money just by giving you an account and a credit limit. And the minute you spend it, the money comes into being and starts circulating, and the bank retires the money then when it is being repaid. So money creation in itself is a fairly neutral issue. The bank creates the money and then retires it when it's repaid. But obviously, it's very strange to pay interest over money that is being created just like that. I mean, it's already strange to pay to rich people who don't need it. But it's even much worse when the money is just being created by credit, by double entry bookkeeping, which is the practice. But what is important here is that this is now a well-known fact, and about 6 months ago or so, the Bank of England published a very important report outlining exactly how it's done, which is a very simple process because, you know, I do it in my own alternative currency every day. It's just bookkeeping. But it was good that they have it off their chest and that they now finally submit how it's actually done, because this has been obscured for really decades, if not centuries. Only the real insiders knew how it was done. Your average economic professor has absolutely no clue about money creation. And but this is now on record. The Bank of England has admitted the whole thing. Not even admitted, just put it forward. This is the way we do it. And this is how it's done globally. But what is crucial to understand here is that the money creation process does look nasty, but the bank, after it has created the money, must find ultimately a deposit. So first they give you the loan, and then they go into the capital markets and attract a deposit to counterbalance the loan that they have given to you. So the new money that starts circulating by for which they have printed for you is taken out of circulation basically by grabbing a deposit on the market, so that the money supply that is actually circulating remains more or less stable. And this nowadays is done mainly by what they call securitization. So in the United States in particular, but also in Europe, the banks nowadays, most of the mortgages they put out, they just sell them to international hedge funds, pension funds, big money gloves that you have out there, who then buy up these mortgages, and this is how they finance these loans. But like you were saying, this is at the moment a really hot issue in the monetary reform movement, and you have outlets like American Monetary Institute and Positive Money, of course, in Britain. These are the two main leading outlets at the moment who really point at money creation and say, this is the problem. Well, it's not the problem. The problem is the usury on the loan. The problem is not debt itself. The problem is the usury on the debt. And because, for instance, let me put this, make this point very clear, because it's very important. If we go into a bank and we take out a 200,000 mortgage for a house, after 30 years, we will have paid off the 200,000 plus 150% of that in usury, which is another 300,000. For the loan, we obtained a house for the 200,000. We got added value for that. Somebody actually worked for that. Somebody gave up property for that. For the usury, we got absolutely nothing in return. Nobody created anything for the income that the bank has been sucking in over 30 years, which is 300,000 euros over a 200,000 mortgage. So we lose much more to usury than to the debt, while the debt itself actually gives us something,
right?
Whereas the usury does not.
Yeah.
The problem, morally speaking, but also economically speaking, is not the debt, not the money creation, but it is the usury on the debt. And current proposals like the AMI and Positive Money, they say money creation is the problem and the state must take over the money creation process. And this is probably better. I agree that this is an improvement, but it is not a very substantial improvement, because what will continue going on is that the banks will still do the lending and they will still be raking in the usury. And what is also very important, they will also still be deciding who gets a loan and not, because that is another very important power that the bankers have.
Yeah.
The bankers decide who can invest in what. And if you can't get a banker loan, then the chance of getting substantial finances someplace else are really very limited. And so they have a huge power in the economy. They can basically direct the economy in whatever way they want. And obviously they do not direct the economy in a beneficial way, in a way that is beneficial for society. They run the economy in a way that is beneficial to their long-term plans, not to their short-term profitability, but to their long-term plans. Let's get that also on record here, because people are far too naive. They think, oh, it's all about short-term gain, blah, blah, blah. Absolutely not the case. That is just, you know, many things in the economy do work like that, but the bankers themselves, they look at the long-term and the long-term strategy. So the money creation issue is what I would call a distraction. And I'm personally convinced that it's that Chicago plan, which is basically what Positive Money and AMI promote, is a distraction and harmless for the bankers, and probably actually what they want to implement anyway, because they will have to, at some point, they will have to show some sort of reform to say, oh, things have gone horribly wrong, trillions in damage, and so many people disowned, but it will never happen again because we've solved the problem, which is money creation, which it is not. The problem is usury.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, we hear a lot of back and forth, you know, about the private versus the nationalized debate and, you know, who controls what and whatnot. And to a certain extent, yeah, exactly. I mean, does that really matter at the end of the day? I mean, if these are, you know, if there's other ways that are manipulative to the economic system per se, and if these are things that really, you know, regulate in what direction things flow, then it doesn't really matter. This is a theatrical debate, really. And I wonder why, because you mentioned that in one of your articles, really, it's a good point, basically, that modern economics is pseudoscience, right? I mean, you compare it with other things we have in our society, like, you know, the medical authority and, you know, even the issues of vaccinations, that you are the crazy one if you question these things, you know, and you mentioned that all modern science had been utterly, you know, corrupted to the core, both through orthodoxy, but also political correctness, you know, under the pressure of power and commerce. So the question is, why are people so surprised that it's the same with economics? Because there are a lot of people out there talking about these issues and alternative things, by the way, but very few actually address the usury issue. And some even, I've heard, even see it as a positive thing of kind of, well, it's good because it creates more money. And when you have more money, you can lend more, ergo, you get more things done in the real world kind of thing, right?
Yeah, there's so many rationalizations. And but really, Henrik, it's absolutely no surprise. The usury issue is so foundational. And what is the absolute core of modern economics? The time value of money, which is the basic rationale for usury. And this is absolutely not for nothing, because usury is really the core of the whole thing. And everybody who has a basic economic literacy, the first time that they start, when they're confronted with the idea that usury is actually a negative issue, they immediately disconnect and they say, oh, well, I wouldn't lend without interest, which is the basic rationale of the time value money. Of the time value of money, and this is just a total lie. We can well organize a monetary system that provides interest-free credit for normal people without anybody having to give anything up from an understanding of mutual interest in cheap credit. And obviously, economics is a total hoax. What else could it be? I mean, we are totally economically enslaved, and this science, so-called, explains why it is so. Of course it's a lie. A lie A to Z. It's complete bogus. It's really nothing adds up in modern economics. It's all a huge, well, a crock, and that's a polite phrase here. I'm having something else in mind.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, obviously, we're going to go into little bit later here, obviously, some of the solutions, some of the alternative currencies out there, what might work. We can save this, I guess, for the second segment here as we continue. But let's just kind of check off some of the boxes here and address some of the issues. What's your view then on, I think you explained this a little bit already, but taxes, taxation, and what level this should be on. And I mean, again, let's go back to the idea of what is originally was, well, maybe not originally, that's wrong, but okay, let's view it from a benign point of view, saying that the idea is that people are coming together, they put in a mutual fund somewhere, and this fund is dedicated towards, for example, you know, having a school or building a road or what have you, right? And this can be done, you know, by government or by private means or however, whoever can organize it. That's not the point. The idea is that there's not a bad idea, I think, if a community wants to achieve something instead of having every individual being specialized and doing everything along the way themselves, you know, laying the road just in front of your house and then the neighbor has to come and do the same on his stretch, et cetera. I mean, these are, so taxes is, I understand that the idea of it might be good, but what's your view on what it does today and how that is contributing to, you know, ripping people off from their own hard work and putting it into foreign wars in you know, fought for Israel, for example, you know?
Yeah, just to mention one little travesty here. So, you're already hinting, of course, and obviously the state as it stands now is a completely adversarial entity, a total enemy of the people, and doesn't matter whatever state you mention, whether it's the Swedish, Dutch, or American state, it's completely beholden to the banks. Its aggressiveness shows both aggressiveness abroad, but also against its own people. For instance, what's happening in the family courts, just to mention one thing. But the way that they are bailing out the banks at the cost of the people, the way that they are borrowing from banks and paying in Europe alone hundreds of billions per year in interest on foreign debt or on sovereign debt, and money which all ends up with banks and ultimately with very wealthy people. Let there be no mistake about that. It's not ending up with poor people saving for a rainy day. No, it all ends up with the very rich. And just see what they're doing to Ireland, to Greece, to Spain. The whole European economy is just being gutted to pay off the interest on the debt, and not the debt itself, because it's the interest on the debt that makes it so punitive, because even Greece could pay off its entire debt in 20 years just with what it loses on debt service, on usury. So it's not the debt, it's the usury on the debt which makes the whole thing totally unsustainable. And states are raking in a lot of taxation just to pay off the usury on the debt. Taxation itself, half of taxation is usury passed on by producers for goods and services that the state buys, whether it's buildings or cars or also the salaries of people that have to pay off their mortgage to banks, etc. So as it stands now, and especially the way that the predatory way that taxes are raked in, for instance, a tax on consumption, food, for instance, people need food and the state taxes this is totally predatory.
Yeah.
And even worse, income tax, which is obviously, if you think about it, 100 years ago, no man ever would allow income tax, even 100 years ago, because that was obviously total slavery to the state and a non-issue and tyranny and etc. And now it's completely normal, but it is not normal. It is still predatory. It is still enslavement. And a rational tax system, I think, should focus on wealth for several reasons. In the first place, what the problem with income tax, for instance, is that it makes labor very expensive. So it's a key cause of unemployment. And a tax on wealth is neutral to the economy. Wealth is what remains after all is said and done in the economy. So after all the production is done, all the consumption is done, then what remains is wealth. And wealth, the wealth of a nation is so big, even today with all debt outstanding, is so big that a state can easily finance itself with a very small tax on wealth. Instead of income tax, etc. But having said that, I think ultimately the state is always a power glut, and experience with the state is not positive. Over if we look back at history, it's the cause of wars.
Yeah.
tyranny of, and I think what I maintain on my website constantly is that the state has always been owned by the plutocracy behind the scenes, and I think that this is a very fair assessment. The state does not operate in the best interest of many people. It operates in the best interest of the most powerful people in the society.
Well, you
So
know, well, exactly. I mean, the state is not the people. It's not for the people. It's not the nation. It's an other entity within it that has turned against the people. But just to give people
exactly.
an example of, you know, for example, what it is in Sweden, we have something. I don't know if the translation is correct here, but we call it, if I would translate directly, the tax-free day. We call it the first day of the year where you measure where your own, you know, sweat equity of the work you've put in that year actually begins to go to yourself as opposed to the state, right? So in Sweden, every year you work 365, well, you don't work 365 days, but every year you work, there's a day where you've worked to pay the state, and then after that point you work to pay yourself. And this year it was on the 16th of July. So you basically work from January to the 16th of July to the state. The share here of the tax is 53.7%. And this has actually gone down a little bit in recent years due to various different things. But back in 2004, it was about 60.5%. And the tax-free day occurred on the 10th of August. But, and I think in America, it's like, it actually is in April around tax day, I think 20th or something like that. But that's a lot. That means we are slaves to the state. We work for them, you know?
But it's very important. I agree fully, but there is an important thing to add, and that is that, like I said, 50% of taxation is usury passed on by throughout the supply chain. And if you simply stop usury and provide interest-free credit to normal people and the state, you would the state would be able to maintain its same level of, well, services is a big word, but you know what I'm saying,
Sure, yeah.
at the half of the cost. So if you end usury, the common man would see his taxation bill go back half. And this is one of the reasons why usury is so, you know, people focus on the taxation because everybody's upset with taxation, but they don't see the hidden rule of money. So that's why I want to point at this clearly here. But taxation is a problem. Even if it's just a quarter, it's still a huge sum.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, you're right. It's the root of the injury, and it adds to an already really bad situation there, of course. Let's just see if there's something else. I think if there's something we should cover here quickly before we take a short break, Anthony. And obviously, we want to give out your website and talk about some of the, you know, the writings that you have available. I know that you're working on. Are you connected to the currency itself?
The Gelder.
The Tellen, exactly. Yes. Tell us more about that.
As I was saying, when I woke up to the political situation, I started digging into alternative currencies, and I opened up my first currency here in 2007 here in Arnhem. Very, really, just Excel sheets keeping scores of transactions, so it was really very primitive. But that basically is how money works. But I had a long process of investigating alternative monetary systems, and really trying to sense what is it that a real comprehensive monetary system needs to operate in the market and to really be able to add real value for particularly the businesses, but also the consumers in the network. And the talent, as it is now available, is basically the end product of that soul searching. And a really important milestone there was when I had launched an improved version of the Gelre in 2000, late 2007. I got hassled by the Dutch Central Bank, who claimed that my activities were illegal, which they were indeed at the time. I was simply not complying with some sort of regulation, and this was really a big problem for the architecture that I had at the time, and it really forced me to think, because I won't go in too deeply here, Henrik, because I've noticed when I try to explain this to people, it all becomes fuzzy and complicated because it is very technical.
Right.
But what it comes down to is that you either have currencies that provide interest-free credit but are not euro convertible, or they are convertible to the national currency, but they cannot provide interest-free credit. And these are the two main systems that you have. The RIA, for instance, is interest-free credit-based, but is not convertible to the Swiss franc. And then you have the German regional currencies like the Chiemgauer, but also, for instance, in Britain, the Brixton pound, the Bristol pound, and the Lewis pound. These are convertible to pounds or euros in Germany, but they cannot provide interest-free credit. And the Talon system is the first system that is commercially available and really ready for action at very low cost for people that they can implement. That provides the architecture for them to create currencies that are both convertible and provide interest-free credit. And it's really the first completely comprehensive alternative architecture out there, which is really what I believe capable of, really combating the real monetary problems that we have, especially in this day and age of liquidity scarcity, banks not lending. A totally out of control debt ratio, small business not being able to get credit from banks, so no investment for them, so no economic growth, etc. We can provide high-class currencies to these local businesses if they are willing to look a little further than the newspapers, what the newspapers are telling them, to become less dependent on this completely ghoulish monetary system of ours.
Yeah, very, very good. There's a lot of things I want to ask you more about. Obviously, the crash we saw in 708, Islam or Muslim banking, I guess. I want to talk a little bit more about why gold is a bad idea. But also a little bit later, the issue of where a lot of focus go today in terms of the fighting that we tend to do with each other within the West. The issues of cultural Marxism, feminism, and things like that. You've written about this, which I do want to get your take on. But give us your website, Anthony, and tell us where people can go to find more of your writings, and if there's anything else you want to mention to our audience here.
Well, my website is realcurrencies.wordpress.com, and my website for the Gelre, my alternative currency is gelre.org. So that's gelre.org. And these are my two main websites, and people can find out about my work there.
All right, we're going to have these linked up from our website as well, Anthony. Stay with us, and we'll be right back after the break.
Stand up, fall, live or die, stand strong and true till the end. Now, fly the flag, let them see, shine. We will never bend the knee. Don't fail, we are the last of all. Yeah, if we give way, we dogs of war. thousand years. Let go the dust of war.
We're going to pick this up right after the break, and when we return in the second hour, we'll talk more about the market crash in 2007-2008, how the boom and bust cycle is planned to put more control of the monetary system into fewer hands. We discuss the rise of China at the expense of the West and the sellouts in our midst that have no allegiance to our people. This gets us into the long-term plan of population replacement and the ever-growing problem that immigration is creating in European societies. We discuss the situation in Holland specifically, but also in broader Europe, and what goals our enemies have in mind beyond displacement. Later, we get Anthony's take on Hitler's finances. As we move forward, we discuss if the solution can and will come from a political perspective, and what option we have when it comes to the political parties in Europe that actually are seeking to get us out of the European Union, first and foremost. It's an interesting discussion, and you shouldn't miss it. You can join us at redicemembers.com for more. It's only €5 per month. We have subscriptions from 3 months up to 2 years available. And also, ahead, folks, we have Mike King, Kerry Bolton, Laird Scranton, and Robert Ferguson, to name a few. And also in the pipeline, Program 2 with John Lash, the follow-up to the last one we did, as promised. It's going to be another good one, so stay tuned for that. And the website, once more, redicemembers.com. We'll speak to you on the other side of this break. Thank you for listening.